What can we expect for the upcoming 2021-2022 school year? Flexibility is going to be key, that's for sure. But there are some things we can still take a look at. Join us as we explore health, budget, and nutrition topics in this episode of Educationally Speaking. Welcome to Educationally Speaking, a podcast which focuses on important topics related to education that affect students, parents, teachers, and administrators. My name is Sarah Davis, the Communications Specialist for Oakland Schools and the host of this podcast. For our first episode of Season 3, we will be talking about what parents and students can expect for the 2021-2022 school year. Admittedly, this is a moving target because the pandemic is ongoing and things could quickly change. But as of right now, it is looking like school districts are going to resume in-person learning. So what will that look like? With guidance from local education experts, we will be discussing some of the key areas that parents and students may be examining upon return to school this year. Our guests are Lori Adkins, Child Nutrition Consultant for Oakland Schools, Dana Bennett, Public Health Nurse Consultant for Oakland Schools, Lisa Hansconnect, Director of Government Relations and Community Services for Oakland Schools, Dr. Julie McDaniel, Safety and Well-being Consultant for Oakland Schools, and at the district level, Dr. Amy Krupe, Superintendent of Hazel Park Schools. We will start with you, Dana, because I think paramount in everyone's minds heading into the school year is health, both mental and physical. Dana, first, thank you for being on the show. And as everyone knows, this coming school year is going to be an evolving situation health-wise as students return back to the classroom. What are some things parents and students may see happening in their district as school administrators prepare for returning to in-person learning?
Thank you for having me. The last few weeks have shown us COVID-19 is an evolving disease. As school districts, schools, school staff, families, and students prepare for the 2021-2022 school year, the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics have recommended all students return to full-time in-person learning for the year. Given the current reality of our situation, that students under the age of 12 are not eligible to be vaccinated, it's important to continue the layering approach to reduce the risk of COVID-19 infection and be as flexible as we can with these changing situations.
Okay, thank you for that, Dana. Amy, thank you for being a guest. Can you provide some examples of the health safety strategies Hazel Park is planning to implement this coming school year?
Sure, thank you for having me. This coming school year, we will be following some of the strategies that we have followed before. So we will have COVID cleaners in the classroom, as we have in the past. We'll be using smaller class sizes and keeping students 3 feet apart, making sure that they're cohorting. We have shields on the desks, keeping kids separated, K-8. But in the high school area, shields on the desks will be left up to the teachers or the students. Our students will be having breakfast and lunch in the lunchroom, and we'll be having students enter through the front with thermoscans, making sure that our temperatures are lowered. We have a nurse that has been hired from Oakland County, so they'll be working with parents and students to make sure quarantining guidelines are followed and connecting with Oakland County Health Department.
All right, and another important subject is masks. There's been a lot of controversy over masks, but we're not going to get into that here on this show, and it seems like each district is handling that situation differently. Dana, can you talk about how, if required, students and parents can properly wear a mask so that it is effective?
Yeah, masking is an effective intervention in protecting people against respiratory viruses. Masking protects others and themselves, as it's possible to have COVID-19 without any symptoms. In laboratory studies, multi-layered cloth masks were more effective than any type of single-layered mask, blocking as much as 50 to 70% of exhaled small droplets and particles. Face masks can be safely worn by all children 2 years of age and older, including most children with special health conditions, but please always consult your healthcare provider. Children should not wear masks if they're under 2 years of age because of suffocation risks. Also, anyone who's unconscious or unable to remove a face covering on their own should not wear one. And also with swimming as well. How to properly wear a mask depends on the proper fit and if it stays on. The mask should be two or more layers of breathable fabric. When trying on a mask, make sure it covers from the nose to your chin, and then move your mouth around to make big facial expressions to see if the mask moves or if it creates any gaps on the side. If it does, try to tighten the mask. If gaps still persist, you may need a new mask. It's helpful to pack extra masks for the school day, and don't forget to wash and completely dry the mask after each use. Remind your children to wash their hands before and after putting the mask on and avoid touching it once it is on.
All right, thank you for that instruction, Dana. One last thing, something that seems to have happened as a result of the pandemic, is that discussions health-wise are dominated by COVID, but students can still get sick with other illnesses. Since it's been a year since many kids have not been in the classroom, what are some other important health items parents should keep in mind for return to school?
Yeah, so August is National Immunization Awareness Month. Over the course of the pandemic, as many families have had to cancel or postpone appointments with their healthcare provider, the Michigan chapter of American Association of Pediatrics stated that last year, routine vaccination rates for children were down about 5% in Michigan. This amounts to tens of thousands of kids not protected from severe but preventable diseases. So planning for back to school should also include scheduling that appointment with your healthcare provider to get caught up with on routine annual examinations, routine vaccinations, and a flu shot once they start to become available. I would also make sure that your medical forms are up to date with your school. Some students may have new medications that they're on or a change in medication from over the previous year. If a student does have a chronic health condition like diabetes, asthma, or seizure disorder, make sure the rescue medications are at school per your school's policy and that those medications are not expired.
Okay, wonderful. Appreciate your insight. Next, I want to touch on the social-emotional aspect of returning back to school, which is just as important as our physical health. Julie, welcome to the show. When you and I talked before, you said a lot of your work more recently has focused on how we can start restoring our communities from the trauma that the pandemic has caused. Obviously, school is a huge part of community. Can you briefly discuss the social-emotional ramifications of the pandemic?
Sure, Sierra. Thank you so much for having me. When we talked before, we talked about the individual impact of COVID-19. And just a quick reminder that our brain serves, first of all, as a smoke detector, always sensing danger. That amygdala lets the system know whether we're safe or not. Once that question of if we're safe or not is answered, then the limbic system, which is the feelings and emotion part of our brain, kicks in and asks, okay, I'm safe, but am I loved? When those two questions are answered with a yes, then the executive functioning part of our brain is able to be engaged. That's the place where we are truly our best selves. We're thinking about others, we're reasoning, we're using words, we're problem solvers. So basically, for at least the first year of the pandemic, and some of us are still in an acute crisis, we live in the back part of our brain. That is truly the me part of our brain. And what we want to do, because so many of us are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, we want to move from that natural instinct of taking care of ourselves to thinking about ourselves as part of a greater community. And so what we want to do is to start to move from me to we. So because many of us feel like the crisis is behind us, we can start dealing with some of the things that have happened naturally. So in crisis, it's natural for disruption to happen in trust. There's more division. There's some places in our school communities that with seemingly irreparable division. our emotions are still high in places. Collectively, we are now actually living in communities in crisis. So our own personal crisis has now been translated into our communities. It's also really important for us to individually note that even though for many of us the crisis is over, there's a reality of post-traumatic stress, which does not set in until 28 days, at least 28 days after the crisis is over. Sometimes it doesn't emerge for years after. And so even if COVID is way behind us, we need to continue to be vigilant, looking at ourselves and the people around us, checking in mental health-wise. We need to look at people who seem to be struggling with deep feelings of apathy or depression or detachment. So in my humble opinion at this point, it is really our moral imperative to move from that crisis survival mode to more of a community mindset so that we're moving from me to we. Children and some adults are not able to do this, but the rest of us certainly can come together in shared purpose for the sake of our children. We know that people heal, that they learn, they thrive, and they grow in strong supportive communities. We also know that the relationships are the backbone of those communities. Our goal always is to repair the relationships in order to restore the strength of our communities. So how do we do this? We have to find common ground. That's in the place of partisan politics, great division over things like vaccination and masks, in the midst of COVID-19, an American racial injustice pandemic, health crises, financial instability, job insecurity, and the threat of variants. Right in the middle of all this, we still have to find common ground.
And that's a long list of things that could make it difficult to come together. So with all of that in mind, what are some ways that we can begin to repair the relationships that are the backbone of strong communities? In other words, how can communities work to find common ground despite all of the things we are feeling right now?
So there are two ways to do this, collective ownership and shared decision making. So the first thing is I want just to be mindful that individuals in crisis, we go to that me part. Our leaders are also, it's necessary for them to think for the organization, to think for their communities. There have been a lot of decisions that have been made by a few people, absolutely necessary in crisis. We are no longer in that acute crisis. I think COVID is going to be with us for a while, and we're starting to learn how to manage within this. We need to feel like our leadership is showing shared ownership and this shared decision making. There are some places, especially in our school community, that parents feel excluded from this. Some of our staff feel silenced and undermined. And while all of this was very normal and really important for us as we moved acutely through the crisis, now that we are starting to have room to breathe and to think, I feel like people really need to feel that they're a part of this thing. So I could believe that we can move from division and turmoil with an explicit and transparent effort to refocus our efforts on something that we can all bond around, which is our children. So if we start thinking about ourselves as a part of humanity, where 15,000 years ago when we started organizing, our children were seen as our future, our children are the meaning of life, I truly believe that we can find common ground by putting children back into that focus, that they are the meaning of what we do. So there's been a group of us that have been meeting in Oakland County for a year now, and we've been going into communities and buildings, districts, to do what we call listening circles, which are community dialogues. And it allows people individually to process some of the pain that they've had. So we've had different circles on what it feels like to go fully remote, what it felt like to be hybrid or face-to-face, what it felt like after the murder of George Floyd, what COVID-19 has done to our individual lives. We love that's hundreds of people now that we have been able to have these listening circles. What we're moving to now is what we're calling community dialogues. So in partnership with Wayne State University, we have created this event and they'll begin in the fall. We have a moderated discussion between two people who are discussing what the purpose of public education is and who gets to determine curriculum and standards. But basically answering the question, why does public school exist? And then who gets to determine what children learn? After this moderated discussion, we are going to have community members come together in small groups to talk about what the moderated discussants have been speaking on. We're going to have them answer questions such as what is the parent role in education? What is the school's role in dealing with social issues? And we believe that if we start focusing solely on our children, that we can come to that common ground, that we can find that shared ownership. And I'm hoping, Sarah, that as we get closer and the logistics get determined, that that maybe I could come back and talk more about what this will look like to see if other districts, community members are interested in having these dialogues happen in their districts.
Yes, absolutely. You're always welcome to be a guest on the podcast. Thank you again for your insight. Always valued here. Amy, has there been anything Hazel Park has done to address the social emotional effects the pandemic may have had on students as they come back to school?
Yes, that's a hard act to follow there, but our theme this year is developing inclusive communities. And I think it goes right along with a lot of those conversations as we focus on positive psychology, social emotional learning, and diversity within our own school district. And I like to talk a little bit about that as we go along, that we're really going to focus on our adults and their feelings and social emotional well-being as they return here at the end of the month. And I think that's really important because our happy teachers and positive teachers make positive children inside the classroom, because when our teachers are well and they're feeling the love, our students are feeling the love and they're learning. And so that's a real focus growth as we're walking into the school year. I think that's really important. And then we are certainly focused on growing our advisory program K through 12, as our students do Monday morning meetings and our junior high and high school do advisory every day to start out the morning to build those strong positive connections between teachers and students that we know will help them engage and want to be inside schools, but also have a person every day that they can connect with to make meeting inside the school environment. And then I think it's also important that last year we worked really hard on trauma-informed learning inside the school so that we knew those connections as well, so that we could understand those students and the connections that they were coming back with and what they were going through. And so this year we know that students will come back again in our school environment. Some of them that have been away for 18 months and been learning virtually and coming back to school for the first time and making those strong connections inside our school environment. So that will be really important again. Now, we were fortunate through all of this to open a clinic through Ascension. And so we do have a lot of support through Social Works and also through a therapist through Ascension. And so I think we have a well-rounded plan as we think about social emotional learning, PBIS, and diversity, equity, and inclusion inside our school district have a real good focus this year to make a great transition positively inside Hazel Park Schools.
Sounds like it. Sounds like a great plan. Now I want to touch on the business side of things. Recently, the legislature decided to pass more funding for schools. Lisa, thank you for being on the show. Can you talk about what happened funding-wise for schools this past year?
Thanks for having me. So the Michigan legislature passed what many are considering a historic school aid funding package just hours before the July 1st deadline. And it includes about $17 billion when you look at the state school aid fund, the general fund, and federal funds. And taken as a whole with the federal dollars, every district will see significantly more than $1,000 per pupil in available state and federal funds. The funding gap that we've always heard about between the lowest and the highest districts since Proposal A passed back in 94, will be gone. Everybody will start with the $8,700 per pupil and go forward from that. The other big thing that's happening in the budget that I want to note is that the budget assumes in-person learning is going to be taking place. It assumes we're going to be back in the classroom and not doing the online remote. And so the sections of law that allowed for greater flexibility in the attendance rules and in pupil accounting are all going back to how it was before COVID. And it'll have a big impact on districts, as some parents may or may not be ready to send their kids back, depending on where things are going now. And we may have to adjust for that going forward. But that's what's passed so far.
Okay, thanks for that summary. And even though it sounds like a lot of money, it doesn't necessarily mean that schools are able to just purchase whatever they like. What are some examples of what this funding can be used for?
So the funding does have to meet certain requirements that relate to COVID, the COVID pandemic, but it is fairly broad. Schools could spend it on increased staff, so that they can have smaller class sizes, allowing for that social distancing that you heard Superintendent Krupe and I think Dana Bennett talked about as well. It can allow for some technology needs if you still do have some that need one-to-one laptops and computers, updated HVAC and air filtration systems or PPE like the masks and those shields to divide the desks. It could be extended learning time. It also could be about the recovery piece. In fact, the federal government said a certain percentage must be for helping kids make up for some of the learning time and the topics that they may have fallen behind on. Maybe mobile classrooms to allow for those smaller class sizes and to have more room so they can divide the kids into smaller groups. And it is worth noting, though, that districts with declining enrollment may still be facing cuts. If you have a significant declining enrollment in your district, even with a larger per pupil money, that per pupil is based on the number of pupils. So if you have less pupils, it may end up sort of balancing each other off. And that's it's important for parents to remember that this isn't just, hey, look, there's gobs of money and we can do anything we want.
Exactly. I think it's important for people to understand that last part of it too. Mm-hmm. And then Amy, always going back to you for that district example, what are some items that Hazel Park plans to use the additional funding for?
Well, we're really grateful, especially as one of those districts that needed that step up in that additional state aid. So we were really fortunate this summer to spend a little under $500,000 for summer school programming that our students really needed after some loss of learning. And these were reading programs, community-based programs that our students told us and our parents told us that they wanted to have happen. And so we had greater enrollment than we've ever had before in summer school in a variety of programming that our parents and students had input in what they wanted to see this summer. One program, which was really exciting, involved the parents with the students about how to teach your children to read at home, and they participated on a weekly basis. Just super excited to be able to provide those programs to our students and our parents. We also have provided an increase of multi-tier system of support teachers for the upcoming school year so that our students have additional one-on-one learning with teachers in school to help increase their learning speed so that they can get back up to speed about where they're supposed to be in that learning cycle. We additionally intend on providing small group tutoring after school and via Zoom in the evenings, because some parents can't have their students stay after school and they need them later into the evening, where it'd be easier for their parents while they're at home to allow them to tutor. So a lot of tutoring, because we know the research tells us that one-on-one or two-on-one time is more effective for students. So we're really focusing those dollars on our students in order to make sure that they're learning at the speeds that they need to learn so that they can be successful in the community.
Yep, a lot of different options there. As we all know, many issues about inequities in our education system were brought to light during the pandemic. One such issue is food accessibility. Welcome to the program, Lori. Can you give us a brief overview of what happened last year as far as food programming for students?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Sarah. So as school buildings closed at the start of the pandemic, student access to food was also cut off. And prior to the pandemic, just about 51% of Michigan kids relied on school meals as their primary source of nutrition. And in Oakland County, that rate's about 30%. So on March 16, 2020, a federal food program called the Unanticipated School Closure SFSP was swiftly put into action across Oakland County and our state to provide breakfast and lunch meals to kids. The impact of the unanticipated school closure SFSP and then subsequent programs have had a tremendous impact on preserving food security for our kids and our families countywide. Students' access to food is really an equity issue, and we all know that hungry kids can't learn. So food really helps level that playing field for student learning in the classroom or at home, wherever that learning was happening. So during the pandemic, many families found themselves needing food assistance for the very first time ever, while some families were impacted to a lesser degree. But in any case, school meals really helped fill the nutrition gap for thousands of kids and families. In fact, just shy about 1 million meals per month on average were served in Oakland County during the pandemic. So in addition to school meals, school food service programs also helped to distribute USDA food boxes during the pandemic. And the USDA food boxes were surplus agricultural foods from USDA that had a variety of fresh fruits and vegetables, dairy products, and meats. And those were distributed to families last spring and summer of 2020. So another food program that really helped families this year was the pandemic EBT program. And this program provided extra dollars for each qualified student that families could spend for the purchase of food. And school food service programs played an essential role in certifying families for this particular pandemic aid program.
Yeah, it was a lot of good stuff last year. So what's happened for this school year?
Well, as we all know, the pandemic is tapering off, but it does continue to linger, and not all families are back to work or are financially stable just yet. So to address continued food insecurity in our nation, USDA issued a series of waivers this past spring that allow school districts to continue to offer breakfast and lunch meals to all students at no cost for the entire 21-22 school year. So that's big news. Now, last year, meals were distributed curbside or outdoors for bulk pickup by families. This year, as kids return to the classroom, school meals will return to the cafeteria. And some districts will continue to implement new service models that support social distancing in cafeterias like hallway kiosks or in-classroom meal service, et cetera. So in fact, for breakfast, we know that the best way to get breakfast to kids in the morning is to meet them where they are. So that means providing meals in the classroom or passing out breakfast to high schools or middle school kids in the hallway as they enter the building. That really helps to improve breakfast access. And breakfast is especially important, as we know, because it's what fuels kids for morning learning. Another thing I'd like to mention for parents of students that may be participating in virtual learning in the fall, parents should check with their district food service department for days and locations of meal pickup for virtual learners. Not all districts are going to offer virtual learning, but for those that are, there may be meals available for their kids.
Yeah, good to know that they're available whether you're in person or virtual, depending on the district. And when we talked earlier, you did mention that some changes have happened to the supply chain that may affect the meals students receive. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Sure. As probably you've heard, our nation is currently experiencing labor shortages, and that's been happening in many sectors of our economy, including and especially in the service sector, especially in the food service industry as a whole. So as a result of worker shortages in the food industry, in general, there have been some wrinkles in food production and distribution channels. And so these channels have been temporarily narrowed for the time being. So what this means for kids in the fall is that some menu choices and food varieties may change from what's listed on the menu with little advance. So in any case, I want parents to know that school meals will continue to be available to all students every day this school year, and that these meals will meet all nutritional requirements for our kids as well.
All right, great. Anything else food related we should be aware of going into this school year?
Well, of course, I'd like to encourage all students to give school lunch and breakfast a try this school year. If you haven't participated in the program before, now's a great time to take advantage of the program. It's convenient for parents and kids. It's fresh, it's delicious, and designed especially for you. So typically each year, parents would need to fill out a free reduced lunch application to qualify their student for meals at no cost. I just want to remind parents, or I want parents to know, that school districts are still going to send home that free and reduced lunch application, or in CEP districts, they're going to send home a household information survey. And why is that? It's because student free and reduced eligibility data is used by school districts for a lot more than just school lunches. So districts use this free and reduced eligibility data for Title I funding, grant funding, E-rate funding, and even PEBT eligibility determination for students. So I just want to urge parents to fill out that free and reduced meal application when it arrives home in your child's backpack. Your district will appreciate it.
Yeah, very important to fill out those forms, kind of how Dana was referencing earlier with updating all the your health and medical information as well.
Right.
Amy, Lori had also mentioned that Hazel Park has an excellent food service program. So can you talk a little bit about what you're going to be doing in that realm for students this year?
Sure. And Lori, I really appreciate you mentioning those forms. I talk about it with parents all the time to explain why it's so important. And we are a CEP district as well. And we're really fortunate to hand out those food boxes for almost a year and a half. And I personally was out there with families and I know that it was really beneficial. And people still stop by on Thursdays looking for those food boxes. They're very helpful. So we served over 141,000 school lunches last year. And not only did our staff stand outside all year long, because we had a lot of virtual families as well, but they were inside those kitchens because we were back into school. So we were really fortunate. We had our bus drivers delivering about 100 lunches to families that could not come in and get them. But we also had volunteers from the United Way coming in, driving food to families that couldn't get them as well. And we took them downtown Detroit and into Troy where our families were because we operate center programs as well. So anyone that needed them, we made sure that people were fed as we fed 7 days of meals and breakfast and lunches to families. So we're really fortunate to have an outstanding food service program and made sure that also those EBT cards, which were really difficult to navigate if families had difficulties, even though it wasn't the school district's responsibility, we made sure that we reached out and helped all our parents do it. Our food service program is fantastic and it really made a difference in people's lives. And we know that. We know that our children need the food and made sure that we communicated on a regular basis out there to anyone in the community that was eligible to get that food to go forward and get it.
Excellent. Well, thank you to each of you for participating in the podcast. You each, you know, have your area of expertise, and I appreciate your insight. I hope that you and all of our listeners have a safe and healthy 2021-2022 school year. This podcast was brought to you by Oakland Schools Intermediate School District's Communication Services and is produced by Media Production and Distance Learning Manager Mark Hansen. Oakland Schools is a regional service agency in Oakland County, Michigan, that offers support services to school personnel, which are better delivered regionally and provide cost, size, and quality advantages to those we serve. I have been your host for this podcast, Sarah Davis, and you can find this and future episodes of Educationally Speaking on our Oakland Schools website at oakland.k12.mi.us and Anchor FM. We hope you will join us for our next episode, where we will continue to bring you topics that affect every student, every day.